This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When Earth Day got started more than 40 years ago, it was largely an American college campus thing before spreading across the country and then across the globe. So maybe it's appropriate that the move toward honoring a full Earth Week appears to be taking hold first in academia, including some universities in Virginia. Of course, in all the time since the initial Earth Day, one question still begs at least an annual review. How's the Earth doing? We've got three environmental scientists on hand to help bring us up to date. I'm not going to speak for them, but from what I understand of their work, it's likely they'll have both some not-so-good news and some really very encouraging words. At least one of those areas of good news coming from right off the coast of Virginia. Of course, if you've got Earth health stories of your own to tell, you're welcome to join the conversation, too, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. We've got one primary question to address this hour, and if you've got thoughts about it, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That question, how's the Earth doing? Of course, you're welcome to also add in any related queries that come to mind. In all numbers, we are at 888-967-2825. We've got three environmental scientists on hand to help. From the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia, Karen McGlathery and Carlton Ray. Plus, from the Department of Biology at James Madison University, Patrice Ludwig. Dr. McGlathery, Dr. Ray, great to have both of you returning to the Insight Airwaves. And Dr. Ludwig, nice to have you with us for the very first time.
Thank you.
So, Karen McGlathery, let me go to you first, if I could. Give us some good news, if you can.
Well, I can tell you a great success story that involves Virginia. When I came here to Virginia in 1996, I began working out on the eastern shore of Virginia in the coastal bays. And at that time, the coastal bays had no seagrass in the bays. These looks like a seagrass meadow would look like your lawn or a prairie completely underwater. And they were very important for the fisheries in the region. And back in the 1930s, the seagrass died as a result of storms and disease, and they never came back, and we thought they never could come back. And then in the late 1990s, right when I first came, a local waterman found a small patch of seagrass, and that spurred a large-scale restoration effort that was spearheaded by our colleagues at the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences. And I can say that now, 13 years later, that started in 2001, we now have 5,000 acres of thriving seagrass in the region. It's the world's largest seagrass restoration. And we also have scallops and other fisheries that are beginning to come back to the region. So we have really begun to restore habitat, a very important habitat, to the area and to coastal areas.
Dr. McGlathery, I remember when you were here, it's like been almost 8 years since you were talking about this project that I think is called the Virginia Coast Reserve Long-Term Ecological Research Project.
Correct, yeah.
And there were any number of things that probably most people didn't know about why salt marshes and seagrass are important, that there's some people listening, believe it or not, who weren't listening 8 years ago. So could you go over some of that again? Why should we care about seagrass?
Well, we should care about seagrasses or salt marshes because they really are, these coastal systems are our first line of defense against storms, for example. So these areas of coastal vegetation help attenuate waves, slow down the wave energy, and also salt marshes absorb a lot of coastal flooding. So they're really important in terms of protecting our coastlines and the communities that live on them. They're also really important for fisheries, as I mentioned, the scallop fishery. So there's a lot of commercially important fish and shellfish and invertebrates like crabs that depend on these habitats.
Help me understand how seagrass helps protect the mainland from storms.
Well, the vegetation, it's a very tall grass, and it helps to slow down the water flow. And that water flow, it helps to take away some of the energy that comes in the waves. And even more so when you get to the intertidal zone of the marsh Oyster reefs, intertidal oyster reefs, do the same thing with small waves that can help break that wave energy.
So the fact that over a bit more than 10 years, you've had this amazing restoration of a type of ecological area that scientists once thought could not be restored, should we take this in some way as a sign of how to look at the environment differently?
Well, what's so unique about the Virginia coastal bays is that they are very pristine. They're not heavily impacted by human activities like, say, the Chesapeake Bay is. And so what's made it so successful is that the habitat is not degraded. And so we've been able to be very successful at restoring them. In other areas, it's more of a challenge if the habitat's degraded by pollution or by disturbance from boats or by filling in from development.
Carlton Ray, Dr. Ray, it's been almost 7 years since you were last here. And I'm afraid that in one of your areas of focus, where you've spent a lot of time in the Bering Sea in the Arctic, you probably don't have a lot of good news for us.
Well, I'm afraid I really don't. In a sense, though, the bright side is it remains relatively undisturbed. It's probably a sea is defined as a part of the ocean. And of the seas on Earth, the Barents Sea, the Mediterranean, all these, all are more disturbed than the Bering Sea is. In other words, we have all the parts. If we could learn to keep the parts. The only problem is Bering Sea is covered by sea ice, which is home to four species of seals, whales, all kinds of things, and walruses, which is what I mainly study. And without sea ice, they'd have more difficulty feeding. They breed on sea ice, so they would have to find some other place, which is not clear in my mind what that would be. And all this is caused by climate change. And the thing about the ocean, without going into the details, it's getting clobbered, the open ocean, by three things. Climate change, warming of the ocean, acidification, which is when carbon dioxide gets in the ocean turns acidic, and third, dead zones, which are caused by over-nutrients coming into coastal zones like northern Gulf of Mexico. And these three things are impossible for us to stop. We could stop the dead zones off the Gulf of Mexico if we could only control the entire Mississippi River, which covers a third of the United States, and stop all those nutrients going in. But that's a problem I think would be very difficult politically and economically for people to swallow. In the Bering Sea, we seem, and in the Arctic Ocean, which is north, we are probably over what we call the tipping point. In other words, the sea ice is disappearing, and when it disappears, it doesn't reflect as much sunlight. Therefore, the ocean warms faster. Therefore, more ice goes, and there's less radiative, you know. So it's a round and round positive feedback, what we call it. And that can't be stopped. Now, we've had a cold winter. The reason we have a cold winter is because the Arctic Ocean is warming. And the Arctic Ocean, when it warms, the air rises and is no longer contained by the jet stream, which used to be way north. And so the air spills over, this cold water spills out. And one of the ways it goes, it comes south through between the Rockies and Greenland, which are high, in the valley, which is the Alberta, down to here. So
What you're saying is those chunks of the polar vortex that we kept hearing about.
The polar vortex is broken down.
And those are much more likely to come our way,
further south. And a few other places.
When the Arctic itself gets a few degrees warmer.
Yeah, and because it already seems to be disappearing, the entire system is changing. We're getting colder, they're getting warmer. And because I don't see an easy solution to this in the next decade or two, I can't help but say it's not a happy picture. There are some good news. It's still going to be productive. Still get other things out of it. Unfortunately, sometimes oil and gas, which is a problem up there. But let's see if I can think of something encouraging.
We'll let you think about that for a moment while I turn to this lady from James Madison University sitting right next to you, biologist Patrice Ludwig. Tell us a little bit about your focus and what you've been finding in the research you've been doing that relates to the health of the environment?
Well, I've really been making my students do it. So a lot of times we don't have an understanding of where species are in the spectrum of their response to the environment and how it's changing over time. And so one of the ways that we're trying to get a handle on that and explore more who needs conservation efforts is to get a sense of how generally organisms are responding to climate change. And so one of the ways that we're doing that is trying to develop conservation action plans and monitoring protocols for different species, kind of focused in Virginia, but ones that are mainly East Coast. So we're looking at hellbenders, so giant salamanders that are called hellbenders because they look like they might do that. And so they're really kind of charismatic megafauna in terms of salamanders, but they're diminishing numbers.
How big is a hellbender salamander?
People will correct me, I'm sure, but I'm going to go from tip of your finger to your elbow in length. They're big and they're massy.
There's one in Asia that's about 3 feet long. Right?
Yeah. So we have some on the East Coast, but they're
so big enough for people to know this and, in your view, to care about.
Yes. And they're kind of markers, just like the seagrass is a marker, just like oysters are a marker. They're a marker for the condition of the environment. And we've seen decreases in their populations over space and time enough that people are starting to notice that. And the problem is with a lot of the species, like the Arctic species and these hellbenders and some other ones, is that they live a long time. And if the organism is going to live a long time, then its probability of responding to environmental change in an evolutionary way is reduced. They don't have time to respond to those changes.
To you who are listening, what environmental issue is of most concern to you? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Vice President of Research at the University of Virginia, as well as Professor of Environmental Sciences at that school, Karen McGlathery is one of our guests. Sitting next to her, longtime Environmental Sciences Research Professor at UVA, G. Carlton Ray, as well as biology department faculty member from James Madison University, Patrice Ludwig. I'm just curious if the three of you and what you've heard in introductory remarks from each other came up with an obvious question you wanted to ask of any of your colleagues.
Well, I have a comment, it's something that Carlton mentioned. He used the term tipping point. And I think that's a really important term to understand. And essentially, it's when one thing, if it's an ecosystem, for example, changes very dramatically to another. So a marsh could become a mudflat, and then suddenly you lose all the value of a marsh. It could probably also relate to a salamander population. And so the idea is that as things change gradually, as the environment changes, like temperature might change gradually, the response of these organisms, of these habitats, isn't necessarily gradual, that it can change to a point and then it can be very catastrophic. It can change very dramatically. And that's not always reversible. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. I think the seagrass is a good example of where it is reversible. But I think that's really one of the greatest challenges to managers and to practitioners in the field to understand maybe to have an early warning sign of when those tipping points might occur.
I agree.
I do too.
Yeah. Carlton, you and I are the oldsters here on the panel.
Thank you.
And we may have the best because we experienced it at an old enough age to remember it. Memory of the first Earth Day.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've heard you say in the past that there are some remarkable differences in how the general public looks at environmental issues today versus back then. I want to ask you more about that when we continue, and we're going to continue in just a bit more than 1 minute.
say mercy means all things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Things ain't what they used to be. Lost more radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are dying.
Way back in 1971, Marvin Gaye was singing about the environment. The song's full title, Mercy, Mercy Me, The Ecology. Our guests, marine ecologist Karen McGlathrie, marine mammalogist Carlton Ray, and conservation biologist Patrice Ludwig. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Going next to Richmond. Kate, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call and to your terrific panel for their insights today. I work with the Virginia Sierra Club in Richmond, Virginia, and have to say that I find it very inspiring to be a part of this work in Virginia because while there are so many worrying signs that we're seeing, the majority of folks are starting to appreciate the reality that our climate is changing in an unprecedented way, and many are taking advantage of the tools available to address this challenge. So I just wanted to say thank you. I think that for me, I would really like to hear you talk a little bit more about both the causes of climate change in terms of our burning of fossil fuels and deforestation, as well as the impacts that we're seeing here in Virginia and how folks can make sense of that a little bit and recognizing that the science does not conflict with our faith beliefs.
None of the three of you are actually climate scientists, but Carlton, you were the one who was talking about what you've seen in the Arctic as a result of climate change. So do you want to address Kate's question?
Yeah, if I can. Now, obviously, not a climate scientist, and I'm not an engineer either. But we scientists always form collaborations with other scientists. And so when we come up with a question about the effect of, let's say, fossil fuel consumption or so forth, we simply ask the question, okay, what is the effect on the indicator organisms and or the ecological function of an environment? That side of the picture, but we deal with both. And I don't think we want to get involved in talking about the industry's burning of fossil fuels. That's another topic for engineers and this kind of thing. But what we want to stick to is the effects and our possible causes. There's one thing about possible causes. We scientists ask questions like what, when, how, where, why, and we can answer most of those questions, but we very seldom can say exactly why something may be occurring. We observe it. We observe the effects of climate change, and we know it's caused by fossil fuel burning, but there's a lot of uncertainty around that. The gap now is closing in. We know that climate change is having a huge effect on this whole planet. I can't think of a place where it isn't in one way or another. In the ocean, which is 20 times as big as the land when you look at the volume of life, we have very little understanding of exactly how carbon operates. And so we do know the effect. Acidification and all these things, but we can't address really the cause in terms of fixing it.
Well, one of the things that I was listening to you and thinking about when you were saying that,
this is Patrice Ludwig.
Oh, I should have done that. Is that we have modeling, right? And we can look at modeling in nature and we can say, this is what we think might be happening. These are the ins to this situation and these are the outs. These are the inputs and these are the outputs. And we don't necessarily train a ton of scientists to think this way. So part of the issue that we're really seeing is that we don't have the workforce, the science creativity going into some of these solutions. For example, burning fossil fuels, we might not be able to change that as our citizens, but can we think creatively? And what are the emergent properties? What happens when we see all of these things working together in a particular system. So I'm thinking about, like, so this is going to seem off topic, but I promise it's going somewhere. So what about dung beetles, right? There's a lot of dung in the world. Australia didn't even have dung beetles for a long time. And so all their dung was just laying around, and they have a lot of livestock. So creatively thinking, they introduced dung beetles. How much can we influence and impact the carbon cycle in a way that you wouldn't necessarily think of? Can we facilitate dung beetle activities to bury more carbon? And does that have an impact? Can we do the same thing in ocean systems? But we need people talking to each other and thinking in ways that are well outside of our normal everyday thinking in order to have that happen.
Kate, thank you so very much for your question and your comment. And we'll hope to talk to you again soon. We'll have to get the Sierra Club here in the studio in the near future. Let's go next to Stanton. Richard, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for Patrice Ludwig, Carlton Ray, and or Karen McGlathery.
Well, my question is about the short-term versus long-term effects of climate change. Now, my impression is that when you have what had been a stable system, which our global climate had been, and you start pumping a lot of energy into it, you destabilize it, put it into at least a semi-chaotic state. And I think that may be what, in the short term, is driving things like some of the very cold winters we've had, for instance, right in this area. Now, some people will say, well, that shows that climate change is just a lot of nonsense because this is cold, not hot. Am I on the right track here? And thinking that even if we stopped everything, whatever the causes may be right now, because we have this extra energy and we haven't reached a stable system yet, that it may be, you know, 50 or 100 years before things actually settle down and we know what the new climate will be.
Well, I might try to answer that. In the first place, systems are never stable. Our economic system isn't stable. Diseases aren't stable. Ecosystems aren't stable. They're under constant change. And the trajectory of change is usually to some state that is sometimes called stable, but really is very vulnerable. It's a complex thing, but the cycle it goes on, and the main problem is not stability. It's whether or not a system can be resilient to change. Resiliency is built into ecosystem behavior, and don't expect stability out of environments. You know, as the oaks grow, different things happen, and different animals come in. But the thing we have to do is, as I said before, keep the pieces. Be sure things are there that can replace others that may disappear, functionally speaking. And the other is try not to whack systems so much. And I think personally that the public needs to get much more involved in these sorts of things, needs to understand how systems behave. And sometimes we scientists, myself particularly, don't get these things across as well as we might. Karen, you got something on that?
Well, I guess I would just add that you know, we talk about these trends when we talk about climate change, but really there's a lot of things that are happening, a lot of variation around this trend. So one of the ideas is that we have we're likely to have more extreme events, whether mm-hmm. it's a storm, and there's some debate about that among scientists, or whether it's periods of drought or heavy rainfall in different regions. And it's not uniform across the globe. And so we have to sort of embrace that variability, I think, mm-hmm. and try to get our head into the long term, the 50-year trajectory that Carlton, or the time frame Carlton was talking about. And I think one of the big tools that we have, to get back to what Patrice was talking about with tools, is to be able to, we know enough, we can model to create future scenarios of change, which embrace that variability. And that can help us understand the risks that we might face and what actions we might want to do in face of those risks.
I completely agree with having the capabilities for looking in the future based on different scenarios. And then looking for places on Earth that might match those? And can we study what's going on, right? The Chesapeake Bay is sinking, which it's mimicking water level rising. So can we study the impacts of a rise in sea level before it actually happens in some places?
Mm-hmm. Richard, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
To you on the other side of your radio, our primary question this hour, how's the Earth doing? Got thoughts on that? Related questions of your own to offer? 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. But if you prefer all numbers, then 888-967-2825. Or if you rather type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. So, G. Carlton Ray, let's go back to you and I being old enough to remember the first Earth Day back in 1970.
Yes. 1970, April 22nd.
Is it your view that the public's view towards environmental issues tends to be a lot different today than it was all those decades ago?
Yes, and it's particularly my view because I was old enough to be there at the time and remember what happened as a result of Rachel Carson's book on pollution, disappearing birds. The ocean took a big part in this. Seals were being clubbed for fur coats. People didn't like that. Dolphins were being killed in tuna seines. Whaling was just rampant. So people got very, very disturbed. They didn't understand necessarily what all these things were, the science and all that. That didn't concern them as much as we have to do something. So a 26-year-old student out in some Midwestern college, I've forgotten which one, got going, and as I say, 20 million people, Paul Newman, Peter Seeger, all sorts of Senator Muskie were there. Nowadays, the situation is reversed, and that is today people know about climate change. Most of them actually agree it may be occurring, and it certainly is. They know about Chesapeake Bay. They know that small animals like, well, salamanders and so forth aren't there. What they are not willing to do is pay the cost or change their habits. Totally the obverse situation. Following World War II, we all had victory gardens. We pitched in all this kind of stuff. In the 60s and 70s, people were much more willing to talk to one another. They didn't disagree to the extent they do today. But now, the environmental costs are huge. Just fixing our water supply, major thing around the world. And people think we're taxed too much or this kind of thing. Not willing to pay for it. And particularly changing their habits is very difficult. Now, I get a feeling, and I've talked to several people about this, that people are beginning to recognize we got a problem. Got a population problem. We've got a problem still with pollution. Air and water are better, but they're still not as good as they could be. And the Arctic in particular is changing and affecting everybody. So I hope it turns around. I really do.
Biologist Patrice Ludwig, I think what I hear Dr. Ray saying is that back in the late 60s and early 70s, the public, the general public, had far less easy access to good scientific information, and yet they seem to have much more willingness to call for the kinds of changes that would help protect the environment. Today, especially with anybody able to go online and look up research papers from all over the world, we have much easier access to good scientific information, but we seem to be in much more disagreement about what needs to be done or what we're willing to do.
Well, I was just taking notes. I wonder if this is a question of apathy versus being misinformed. There's so many different points of view, and you can make a slick web page with very little effort, right? And so there's ways to get information across. And if we don't have informed citizenry, then they can't discern what's scientific information versus opinion. And I don't think Google necessarily helps that because they give you websites based on your previous searches. So they're just basically recapitulating the same idea to you over and over again. So I think this, I agree that it seems to be a too big of a problem for people to wrap their head around. So they stop and they don't go any further. And that's that's our job, I think. That's our job to address.
People don't want, no, you're right. People don't want to hear bad news. They just don't. They turn off.
But I guess I would add by saying, so as a coastal ecologist, bad things happen, right? We have big hurricanes that plow through coastline and people suffer a lot. And I think those big events get people's attention mm-hmm. and make people think more about the problem. And I go back to what the first caller said, who said, you know, people are appreciate the reality that things are changing. There can be disagreement about among some constituents about what the cause is. But people see, if you live on the coast, you see that there's greater coastal flooding that happened 4 or 5 decades ago. And so mm-hmm. what tools do we have, do people have, to begin to address that? How do they adapt to it? And I think that's a conversation that didn't happen 40 years ago. And that's a conversation I think that's happening more now.
From the Department of Biology at James Madison University, Patrice Ludwig is one of our guests. From the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia, G. Carlton Ray and Karen McGlathrey are with us, too. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Next to Orkney Springs, April, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Well, Tom, I applaud you for addressing this important question today. How is the Earth doing? And extremely tragically, it's doing very poorly and heading in a bad direction. I had called to talk about the wave of extinctions that we're facing, although I feel like I want to respond to what I just heard while I was waiting on the phone about our need for informed citizenry, which is absolutely imperative. But one of the main reasons we don't have the informed citizenry clamoring for action on climate change is fossil fuel industry has done a great job of sowing misinformation purposely. It's a well-funded effort, and they've got their friends in Congress denying climate change is even a problem. We saw in 2012 every one of the Republicans seeking the presidential nomination publicly denied climate change, even though all the scientific evidence is on the side of climate change. And you know, I think we just all need to be really speaking out and trying to educate ourselves and talk to other people around us about it's an emergency.
Tell us a little bit before we hit the break, April, about your concern about extinctions as well.
Well, I'm reading a very good book now called The Sixth Extinction by a science writer named Elizabeth Colbert. And she talks about how in the Earth's 4.5 billion year history, there have been 5 major massive waves of extinction. And now many scientists have renamed our own geological epoch the Anthropocene, anthro for man, because we are causing yet another huge wave of extinctions. And, you know, she makes it very graphic because she talks about the background extinction rate, meaning the number of species that would just go extinct naturally if humans were not involved. And it's a very low rate, like maybe one mammal every 700 years and one amphibian every 1,000 years. And yet, in our lifetime, we've seen many species of amphibians go extinct and several species of mammals. And you know,
April, I'm sorry to cut you short. We are about to hit the break, but I know our panel wants to respond and pick up where you left off. And okay, we'll give them a chance to do that in just a few moments.
They paid paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah. Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people $1.50 just to see them.
Hard to believe that song dates back more than 40 years, to 1970, the year of what would become the first annual Earth Day. Title of Joni Mitchell's song, of course, Big Yellow Taxi. Although their growing up years were separated by a few decades, G. Carlton Ray and Patrice Ludwig actually have some childhood experiences in common. They both admit to spending huge amounts of time as kids digging in the dirt and being absolutely fascinated by the critters who live there. They also both focus much of their early scientific research on salamanders. Karen McGlathrey, on the other hand, is reported to have been fascinated by water and sea creatures from an early age. That might have had something to do with growing up on the coast of Connecticut, as well as having a grandfather who was a sea captain. Today, Doctors Ray, Ludwig, and McGlathery are all environmental researchers. Dr. Ludwig, based at James Madison University. Doctors Ray and McGlathery at the University of Virginia. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Who wants to respond to our previous caller, April, talking about extinctions?
Well, I think April made a really important point in talking about the rate versus the absolute number. Because if you look in evolutionary history, 99% of the species that have ever been here are not here anymore. They are gone. But it's the rate at which it's happening right now. And so part of the basic research and funding dollars out there, taxpayer dollars, go to trying to understand the impacts that losing these species will have on functioning ecosystems. And I think you have a little more experience in that than I do.
Well, I'm not sure, but I started with salamanders. I was inspired by their beauty. I once recommended to the National Geographic to have an article on salamander eyes. They are gorgeous. But aside from that, the extinctions, but the rates of discovery are going up too. You can make arguments that there are between 5 and 100 million species on Earth. When you include microbes, God knows what we've got. The thing that's notable about extinctions is the big things, the consumers that have gone. Things like birds, big marine mammals, and there are an awful lot more that are depleted. This is a particular crisis because aside from the fact that these are charismatic, lovely things we care about, these are drivers of ecosystems, behavior, and function. They consume a lot, and they also poop a lot. You know, they recycle nutrients. They do all kinds of things that are important to us as if we want to use the environment. It's that higher level extinction that strikes me as particularly worrisome. And, elephants, tigers, all these things. And it's a real crisis.
Just in terms of seed dispersal, if you have big mammals and birds eating seeds and moving seeds away from parent trees and things like that, if that's not happening, then competition is high and the established trees are going to win. And then you don't see any recruitment into the next generations. And if there is some storm or some anomaly come through and knock everybody down, then your age classes of who's available are none.
Mm-hmm. Next to Harrisonburg, Charlie, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Patrice Ludwig, Carlton Ray, and or Karen McGlathery, please.
Yeah, it's more of a comment, I guess, than a question. I want to thank you for having the program on Earth Day, and I also want to say that the big issue that we have now is, of course, climate change. The problem is that the carbon in the air is not something that you can see, and so it's real hard to get people involved with it. But it's the same thing that happened with the tobacco industry. They managed to run a smokescreen, and the fossil fuel industry is doing the same thing. And, one of the reasons that many of us have been fighting the KXL is because that is something that you can see. The tar sands are very, very detrimental to the climate. And I was one of those that was arrested at the White House fighting the KXL. And it's such an important issue. And, when Earth Day got started, it was a matter of, the chemicals on our lawns and our gardens and so on. Those are things you can see, and you can see quick changes. But what we're dealing with now is something that's a long-term change, and we're not facing up to it. And the politics of it and the deniers are incredible. And I'm really getting tired of even commenting.
Well, Charlie, thank you so very much for taking the time to share your perspective with
us. Thank you.
Dr. McGlathery, you mentioned early in the hour the concept of tipping point. I guess I had always thought of the notion of reaching a tipping point, meaning there's no turning back. But based on the context of what I was hearing you say, you might have been using that term a different way?
Well, there are circumstances where there are tipping points. If an ecosystem is degraded enough and it reaches a tipping point, there is something called hysteresis that may prevent that ecosystem from returning, even if the environment goes back to some earlier state. So that's what we worry about. But there are also other examples where there can be a return, even if it doesn't go back in the same way, like the seagrass example, you can get seagrasses again. So it's not always a one-way loss. You can have restored or returning systems.
So is a tipping point, and this is for any of you, a tipping point with a warming climate, does that term mean that we've gotten to the point where there are actual significant effects going on? Or are you using the term tipping point as we've gotten past the point where we can reverse the harm?
What it means is the gentleman just called in mentioned long-term changes. Tipping points are sudden changes. And this is what we're up against. The system will go along and it looks stable until, with variability, of course, but all of a sudden you reach a point where the system breaks down, essentially. It's destabilized as the polar vortex has been destabilized, causing a lot of cold air to come on upon us now. And usually those things are very difficult or fairly long-term to correct.
I think it's exactly what you're saying. You can... If we think about equilibrium points and perhaps reaching equilibrium points, and if we destabilize where we are now and move out of an equilibrium point, we can move into a new one that's going to look completely different than the one that we've known in the past. And it might be such that you're not going to get back to your previous equilibrium point.
Okay.
So one example I could give is of a coral reef. So coral reefs are very sensitive to climate change and to increases in temperature. And there's a certain tipping point. There's a certain threshold where if the temperature goes above that, then the corals will die. And what could grow on those reef structures are algae. And they do fine at higher temperatures. And they actually do great with increased carbon dioxide. And so you can get to a new kind of state where you go past the tipping point, you lose the corals, and you get an algal reef.
Right.
And that's one very clear example.
One thing I'd like to comment on, if I could, we are not talking much about humans here. And if you look all around us, the thing most notable is how many of us there are and growing, and how many things we need or use and growing. Doesn't this strike anybody as coming somewhere near a limit? I mean, we live in a planet, which we call Earth. If you look at the Earth from space, you'd call it ocean. I mean, that's obvious. But anywhere, water or something. But I'm not going to project a tipping point in population. But food is getting more difficult to grow because of space and other things, and we're growing. And this seems to me we have to look at that along with the rest of the Earth.
Our history does not do us well in that case, because for every huge increase in the number of people on the planet, human ingenuity has found some way to deal with it,
yeah.
Right? And so we're not actually seeing the consequences of any population increases because we keep band-aiding problems.
That's right.
And so I don't know that is a little bit scary, that we don't know where we're going to reset that kind of Earth's carrying capacity. Where is that going to be? And we don't know if we've passed it or not. Because for all intents and purposes, we've passed it several times, right? We just keep moving that bar higher and higher with technological innovations and things like that.
Karen McGlathrey, what Patrice is talking about reminds me that I've heard you talk in the past about environmentalists and people concerned about significant environmental changes, whether it's a warming climate or something else. Thinking in terms of two approaches, one that I guess is called mitigation and one is called adaptation. And if I've got that right, Karen, could you tell us about both of those?
Sure. Well, there's two issues here. One is slowing down a process that's changing, like the increase in carbon dioxide. And that would be by changing our behaviors, such as deforestation or burning of fossil fuels, so that the increase in carbon dioxide would slow down. And that would be thought of as mitigation. The other part of the puzzle is the idea that things are changing and the reality that things are changing, just like our caller said. And so there is a reality that we have to adapt to that change, even as we're mitigating it. But we have tools, we have an ability to understand, if we do our job well, how those changes are going to look, what those changes are going to look like in the future, and what kind of actions that we could take that would help lessen the effects, lessen the risks or the costs. And so that's really adaptation. And it goes back to that third term that Carlton, I think, raised earlier, which is the idea of resilience. If you can adapt to change, you can move forward even if there is some change. So a resilient system is one that can just can maintain some sort of bumps and bruises, but keep on moving along.
I think that's exactly right. And here's where our knowledge is power, right? So some of these things that an individual can do on their own, and some of them are going to take a concerted effort across a national effort.
Well, yeah, I guess I'd just reflect on the three of us have something in common, which we haven't brought up. We're basically naturalists. We do what I hope some semblance of what Darwin did. You go out and use your eyes and use your senses, all of them put together, to get some sort of a feel for what's happening to the natural environment. And a lot of the things that I feel, I can't prove. I just look and feel and ask questions, and I'm fundamentally basically worried about the direction we're going. And I think the key to that is to get off of our computers, get off of Google for a while, spend a little time on the porch looking out, see what you can see, and see if you can detect any change. Just off your back porch. Try to understand nature a little more. A little more respect.
So taking time to be outside. Training ourselves to be observers.
Yeah.
Kara McLathrie, we started the hour with you describing what has been a remarkably successful effort off the coast of Eastern Virginia to regrow seagrass that people thought was gone for good. We've heard Carlton describe with some significant dismay these creatures that he's spent so many years studying in the Arctic, the walrus, and other creatures that live with them, and how, in his view, they're really being decimated by a warming climate. Can we take from this that you are an optimist and he is a pessimist? Or is it your view that there are some things that can be changed even when most people think it can't? And there are some things that we're not going to mitigate?
Yes. I mean, I would say, I think just as Patrice pointed out earlier when she was talking about extinction, there are some things that are going to happen that we're not going to be happy about. But there are some things that we can change in a positive way. I take your example about looking, and yours, Carlton, about looking around. There are areas, for example, the Red Sea, where corals are growing in very acidic waters, and they're doing well. So what can we learn from that? Are there things, there are others, coral species that do better than some in French Polynesia. What can we learn from that? So I do have a sense of optimism. I don't mean to cloud my deep concern and worry about the trends and the need for mitigation. But I'm teaching a class right now on global coastal change. And what I hear every day from the students is, I don't want a depressing lecture. I want to be motivated. I want to feel that I can do something and make a difference. And so part of what you're hearing is what I've learned from my students.
I think one thing on that, you know, Winston Churchill made a wonderful remark. He said, I have no choice. I'm an optimist. You've got to be an optimist to get anything done. So whereas some of us have a worrisome approach to things, that doesn't mean we're necessarily pessimists. So I agree with what Karen's saying.
You just want to see people motivated to do something.
You got that right.
We want agents of change.
Yeah, we're responsible for our own actions.
Yeah.
Our guests have been from James Madison University, conservation biologist Patrice Ludwig, plus from the University of Virginia, Vice President of Research and Marine Ecologist Karen McLathrie, as well as Research Professor and Marine Mammalogist G. Carlton, Ray, thank you all so very much for making time
thank
for
you,
us.
Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Binge. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. Recordings of previous Virginia Insight broadcasts available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about our guests and the work they are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.